Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mary Huss, member of the club's Board of Governors, publisher of the San Francisco Business Times, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. Today, we are pleased to present the Walter Hoadley Annual Economic Forecast, named in honor of the club's late past president and longtime board member, Dr. Walter Hoadley. Dr. Hoadley also served most notably as Chief Economist and Vice President of the Bank of America. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Robert Reich. Robert B. Reich is Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He has written 10 books, including The Work of Nations, which has been translated into 22 languages, the bestsellers The Future of Success and Locked in the Cabinet, and his most recent book, Reason. His articles have appeared in The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. Mr. Reich is co-founding editor of the American Prospect magazine. His weekly commentaries on public radio's marketplace are heard by nearly 5 million people. In 2003, Reich was awarded the prestigious Vaclav Havel Foundation Prize by the former Czech president for his pioneering work in economic and social thought. In 2002, Mr. Reich ran for the Democratic nomination for governor of Massachusetts. In 2005, his play Public Exposure broke box office records at its world premiere on Cape Cod. As the nation's 22nd Secretary of Labor, Mr. Reich implemented the Family and Medical Leave Act, led a national fight against sweatshops in the U.S. and illegal child labor around the world, headed the administration's successful effort to raise the minimum wage, secured workers' pensions, and launched job training programs, one-stop career centers, and school-to-work initiatives. Under his leadership, the Department of Labor won more than 30 awards for innovation. A 1996 poll of cabinet experts conducted by the Hearst newspapers rated him the most effective cabinet secretary during the Clinton administration. Mr. Reich has been a member of the faculties of Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government and of Brandeis University. He received his BA from Dartmouth College, his MA from Oxford University, where he's a Rhodes Scholar, and his JD from Yale Law School. And we're most fortunate to have him now with us in the Bay Area. Please welcome Robert Reich.
Well, thank you very much, Mary, and thank all of you for inviting me today to address the Commonwealth Club. This is the, third time I have had this privilege. When I was Secretary of Labor in 1995, I was here, and some of you might even remember the first time I appeared, 1985. I do this once a decade, and I hope we can go on doing this for many, many decades to come. That you invited me today to make an economic prediction or make economic predictions on Friday the 13th attests to the inherent optimism and good cheer I found here. Actually, I've been a resident of California for 4 days now, and I love it here. I don't know why it took me 59 years to get here, but I'm here. I have done economic policy for many, many years, taught it, researched it, and practiced it. Economic policy making is a strange art halfway between economics and politics. Politics, as many of you know, comes from the Greek root poly, meaning many, and ticks, small blood-sucking insects. No, I don't mean that at all. No, I don't mean that. That was a joke, and I really have enormous respect for people who devote their lives to politics. Economics, however, is another story. An economist is someone, perhaps you know this, who did not have the personality to become an accountant. And in both of these respects, I've worked very hard over the years. Economic predictions. I did get a reputation some years ago for being a soothsayer when it came to the future of the economy. And I am going to make some predictions and talk a little bit about where we're going today. If any of you feels compelled while I talk to run out and call your broker, that is perfectly permissible. Rude, but permissible. My reputation, by the way, I should confess, comes from way back in the first week of October of 1987, when the issue on television, on a television program I was on, I was debating an economist, and the issue was before us, what's going to happen to this extraordinary bull market over the next couple of months? And I don't know how many of you remember what happened in the third week of October of 1987, but in the first week of October of 1987, there we were, and we were debating, and he, this opponent of mine, was so bullish, so positive, he said to the assembled audience, the television audience, he said, get in the market if you're not in. This bull market over the next couple of months is going to go unbelievably, unbelievably high. If you're not in, get in. If you're in, get in deeper. Don't even wait to the end of this television program to call your broker. I mean, he was almost frothing at the mouth. And finally, it came to my turn, and I said, no, he's absolutely wrong. Everything he said is wrong. In fact, I know this, in 2 weeks, the market is going to lose 20% of its value. There is a tape of this program, by the way. I said, don't even get in the market. If you're in, get out. Don't wait to the end of this program to get out. In retrospect, I don't think anybody saw the end of the program, regardless of who they believe, but 2 weeks later, the market did lose 20% of its value, and I was deluged with calls, people wanting to know how to sign up for my investment letter. And I said with some sadness that I did not have an investment letter. I contemplated the possibility of making billions by sending out economic predictions, but I forbore from doing that, but I will explain to you why, but keep it within this room, if you would. I have a confession. That prediction I was making, that in 2 weeks the market would lose 20% of its value, I'd been making exactly the same prediction for 4.5 years. I missed the entire Reagan bull market altogether. Which just goes to show that if you are making economic predictions and you stick to your guns, eventually you can have your own investment letter. So I am going to talk about the economy. By the way, you all have little cards at your places, and you can write down questions, and we'll get to your questions. I'm going to talk for about the next 28 minutes, and we will get to your questions. Some of you, I saw over lunch, you were already writing questions before I even talked, which shows great prescience on your part, because you don't even know what I was going to say. The economy, the good news. Let's start out with the good news, because let's begin on a high note and then end on a more troubling note. The economy is right now performing quite well. Economic growth is pretty good. We're up to about between 3.5% and 4%. It looks as though we are growing quite well. Unemployment is down. We now know the last time we measured it, down to about 4.9%. A lot of new jobs are being created, not as many as we would like in this economy, but at least on the surface, it looks like this is a fairly good recovery, not a fourth gear recovery, sort of more like a second gear recovery. It's a good recovery, a solid recovery. The fourth year of a recovery, you'd expect more job growth, you'd expect a little bit more vigor, a little bit more investment, but it's not bad. It's not bad. That's the end of my report, folks, but now I want to go on to some storm clouds on the horizon that are serious. In fact, they're bigger than storm clouds. They might be called hurricanes. If you live where I used to live, you ought to pay attention to them. Each of them is severe enough potentially to knock the economy way off track and even potentially force us back into a recession. I'm not predicting that, but I am worried about them. I don't think that any of them are going to hit over the next few months, But I do think that before the end of 2006, one of them is likely to hit. And let me go through these, each of the three, in some detail. I don't think they'll be news to you. You've sort of heard about them, or you've heard about pieces of them, but perhaps if I do my job today, I'll put them together in a way that may be more coherent than the way you've heard bits and pieces of them. The first storm cloud has to do with China. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that China is growing so fast, and its appetite for raw materials and oil is so voracious that China is inevitably causing the prices of oil and raw materials around the world to trend upward. Demand is greater than supply. And I don't want to blame only China. In fact, much of Asia is now booming. India is becoming, in its own way, it will, it's on the way to becoming a powerhouse. But China is the epicenter. Japan also is now back on track, but China is the epicenter. And the demands that the Chinese economy and those related economies are making is going to keep oil at over $60 a barrel for quite some time. Now, there was a loud sigh of relief in America after Katrina, after oil prices settled back. We thought, well, we don't really have to worry that much. But the reason we felt such relief was because the effects of Katrina were not as severe as we had worried about. Oil prices were already trending upwards before Katrina, and they were propelled largely by world economic demand. It's not just oil, it's also natural gas. You here in California, even Northern California, don't have to worry quite as much as the people where I just came from before Sunday. In New England, oil prices, natural gas prices, heating prices are skyrocketing. In fact, our heating bill for December, I'm happy to say the last heating bill I will ever pay, that heating bill was double what it was last year. And that's been the trend in New England, the northern, middle states, and it will be the trend around the country. It's not just heating, obviously. These oil prices, natural gas prices, raw materials prices, people are not talking enough about raw materials prices trending upward either. Raw materials prices are trending upward. All of these will act as a drag on the American economy and potentially a very large drag. Also in the news, at least today, has been Iran and the question of what will China do in terms of cooperating with the United States and Europe on possibly sanctioning Iran with regard to its nuclear energy program. Don't expect China is going to easily come around. China has, in its foreign policy, been acutely aware of the importance of maintaining or developing good relationships with energy-producing nations, oil-producing nations. China is likely, in my view, to want to curry the favor of Iran. Trend number two has to do with not only the deficit here in the United States, but also our extraordinarily low savings rate as individuals. There are giant imbalances in the global economy right now, and those imbalances cannot go on forever. The imbalance I'm referring to primarily is the imbalance between the amount that America spends and what we actually save, public sector and private sector. That balance, or that imbalance, rather, is being remedied by Asia primarily. We are borrowing more than $2 billion a day, mostly from Asia. We are living very, very, very high on the hog. And there's an old economic saying, and that is when you're living too high on the hog, you may inevitably, in fact, not may, inevitably you will fall off the hog and find yourself in pig slop. It's a homey economic saying, particularly after lunch. But what I mean by that is we have let me just talk about the budget deficit, because when I came to Washington in 1993, Bill Clinton had asked me to head his economic transition team. I didn't know what an economic transition team was, but I said, okay, I would. And we put together a great team, Bob Rubin and Laura Tyson and a whole bunch of people. And we discovered that the budget deficit, the structural budget deficit built in to the federal budget when Bill Clinton arrived in Washington was about $300 billion a year, almost as far as the eye could see, to use or paraphrase David Stockman's immemorial phrase. And we knew that the only way that we could get the cooperation of Wall Street and the Fed to reduce short-term interest rates and not to worry about inflation was to get control over that budget deficit. And the first years of the Clinton administration, that's basically all we did. We cut spending and raised moderately taxes. And we got that budget deficit under control. And finally, there was a balanced budget, and finally, in fact, there was a surplus by the end of the Clinton years. And you know what has happened. This is not meant to be, and I'm not going to use this forum to be a partisan address. I'm not partisan about these things. I am a Democrat. Some of you are Republicans. I respect you, you Republicans. I don't like you, but I respect you. But I suspect that we all agree. No, I respect and like you, obviously. But I suspect that we all agree, or most of us agree, about a couple of things when it comes to the budget deficit. And that is that if your economy, if the national economy is operating below capacity, if there's a lot of underutilized capacity, a budget deficit is not necessarily bad. In fact, it might be good in terms of getting the economy going. John Maynard Keynes made that point years ago. But as you move toward full capacity, a budget deficit can cause a great deal of mischief. Corollary number two is that if the government is spending money on things that build your economy in the future, like education and research, basic research of the kind that individual companies will not do, or infrastructure, and it's doing it wisely, and as a result the economy is growing, that's not a bad budget deficit. If the budget deficit results, that may be also a good deficit. The problem is the current budget deficit, which yesterday was revealed to be about $400 billion, at least that's the projection for 2006, $400 billion, with no let-up at all. That budget deficit comes when the economy is almost at full capacity, and that budget deficit is not based on spending of an investment sort, not on education or infrastructure or basic research. That spending is spending that we will never see the results of. Now, some might say that the military spending is a sort of investment with regard to our future. We can debate that. But more and more of that federal budget is being spent on old or elderly people. Now, I am a baby boomer, an early boomer, one of the earliest boomers. The boomer generation was, between 1946, I was born in 1946, the boomers were spanned between 1946 and 1964. 76 million of us. Anybody in this room born between 1946 and 1964? Put up your hands. Several of you. And others of you don't want to admit it. The fact of the matter is that we have now a $400 billion projected budget deficit, and on top of that, the boomers have not yet retired. Now, I was a trustee in my capacity as Labor Secretary of the Social Security Trust Fund. I can tell you that Social Security is not nearly the problem that Medicare is. In fact, Social Security, if the economy continues to grow at a rate approximately between 2.5% and 3% a year, Social Security will not be much of a problem at all. It can be remedied very, very easily. Medicare, however, is a huge potential problem. There is just no money, nearly enough, to pay for the Medicare bills we already have and the baby boomers' Medicare. the Bush administration is going to push for an extension of the tax cuts that were made in 2001 and 2003. And on top of that, although the Bush administration has not yet said it, there are many in the Senate and Congress who want to provide relief from the alternative minimum tax. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do all that, and you also want to fight a war, and you also want to provide homeland security, and you also want to do something for New Orleans, you are fooling yourself if you think that we are able to do it. We can't. That is a recipe for economic disaster. I was never in the Clinton administration a deficit hawk. I was a deficit dove. But I can tell you, we have moved so far in the opposite direction that I'm becoming and sounding like a deficit hawk. The fact that, and you know what I mean, or in terms of what I'm about to say, it's going to sound a little technical, but long-term yields and that yield curve, which is starting to be backward bending, that is short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates are almost the same now, that's a signal of some potential problem. The bond market is worried about the long term. And I'll tell you, the reason there is that worry has to do with that budget deficit, combined with something else I mentioned a moment ago, and that is the low savings rate. We are saving individually. We're saving almost nothing. In fact, we have a record low amount of savings. Part of the reason is that a lot of Americans thought that they would do better in terms of their wages and their benefits. And what we are seeing and have seen over the last few years is that median wages and benefits adjusted for inflation are trending downward. How are people going to save if the median wage and benefit adjusted for inflation is lower today than it was in 2001? Now, you hear some Pollyannas come back and say, well, average wages and benefits are going up. It's true, average wages and benefits are going up. Shaquille O'Neal, the basketball player, and I have an average height of 5'10". Averages are not the issue. There is a difference between average and median. And the more relevant issue is median. Median is the point where half the people in the country are on one side of the median. That's what the median means. Averages are being pulled upward because people at the top are doing better than ever. But that's not where America is. And that brings me to my third and final storm cloud, hurricane cloud on the horizon. It has to do with consumers. Pay a lot of attention to this. Consumer spending is 70% of the economy. Consumer spending is what basically got us through the last recession without it being worse. Consumers have continued to spend. Now, how is it that consumers can continue to spend when median wages and benefits are going downward? Well, one reason they have been able to continue to spend is that they're working more hours and more spouses are at work. The trend is a long-term trend. It's gone on for 30 years, but we've seen it accelerate. People are working more and more hours, more and more spouses, even of very young children are now in the workforce. But there is a limit to how many hours and how many jobs people can do. And we are rapidly approaching that limit. The other reason consumers continue to spend, even though median wages and benefits are trending downward, is because they got a lot of equity out of their homes, particularly over the last few years. Home equity was like a piggy bank, kept a lot of consumers going. But what we are beginning to see is a slowdown, dramatic slowdown, in the housing market. Now, I don't think we're going to see a bubble bursting, but we are seeing, in particularly in some of the highest priced areas around the country, we are beginning to see some softening. I love these words, softening. Inventory buildup. softening of the housing market. That means that housing prices are flat or actually even going down a bit. What does this mean? It means that no longer are consumers going to be able to get a lot of equity out of their homes. In fact, some consumers with variable rate mortgages are going to find it difficult even to meet the mortgage payments. In other words, all of the coping mechanisms that consumers have used, I'm talking about mechanisms they've used to cope with the fact that median wages and benefits have trended downward. Those coping mechanisms to keep on spending are just about spent. We got through Christmas. Wasn't a tremendous Christmas buying season. In fact, most retailers were somewhat disappointed. Unless you're an upper-end retailer, unless you're a retailer right at the top, well, you did quite well because, of course, people at the top are doing extremely well. But watch out, consumer spending, this coming year and the year after. Boy, are your faces long. I have delivered just such an upbeat message today that you just are saying to yourself, why did I ever come and hear this guy? I don't mean to put a damper on all of you. I mean to be just realistic. And the realism comes from an understanding of, number one, the global economy, supply and demand in the global economy, particularly, as I said, for raw materials and oil and energy. Number two, being realistic about the fact we're not saving. Our budget deficit has got to come down. It's insane to extend those tax cuts. And number three, being realistic about the fact that consumers are at the end of their tethers. We just can't spend like we're spending. We've got to save more, but that may have a macroeconomic slowdown effect on the economy. I am, by nature and temperament, a Pollyanna, an upbeat person, an optimist. You can't have spent half of your adult life in the federal government without being extraordinarily optimistic or foolish or both. But I do want to be realistic. My prediction, again, is a healthy economy and a buoyant economy for the next few months, and then second half of 2006, I am very concerned that one or more of the three storms that I mentioned to you will start hitting the economy. That's my prediction for you today. I wish I could be more upbeat with you. I'm anxious to have your questions. I'll try to be more upbeat when I answer your questions. And thank you all very, very much.
Our thanks to Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and professor at the University of California at Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy, for his comments today. I'm Barbara Otto, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Professor Reich, we have an extraordinary number of questions, so let's begin.
Well, we have about 2.5 hours, right? For questions? No, we have a half an hour.
Actually, this may take us to the midnight buffet. Okay. If you were in the Bush cabinet today, that is, suspend disbelief, what specific actions would you recommend to improve our economic outlook given the current domestic and foreign policy challenges we face?
Well, the first thing I do is strongly recommend to the president that he not seek an extension of those tax cuts. They are justified on the basis of something called supply-side economics. And supply-side economics is one of those unfortunate economic theories to have been tried in real life, and it failed miserably. In the 1980s, we did have a bull market. Taxes were cut. But we ended the 80s and the early 1990s with, as I said, a huge budget deficit. You can't avoid it. There's no free lunch here. So I'd say, don't do it. And I'd roll back those 2001, 2003 tax cuts, particularly on the wealthy, not for the middle class, but for the wealthy. I don't think they need it, quite frankly, and I hope I'm not raining on any of your parades. What else would I do? I would invest more and I would invest more wisely in early childhood education, in education generally, particularly in our poor areas of this country. Another thing I would do is I would try to tackle something that years ago I termed corporate welfare. Any of you who took a look at the highway bill last summer and the energy bill last summer probably were treated to something that you didn't want to look at. Those bills had more pork, more subsidies for big American corporations, more unnecessary spending than any set of bills I have ever seen or ever come across. So I'd get rid of all of that, save all of that money as well. And then finally, I'd provide incentives for individuals to save, perhaps means-tested, but if you have somebody who's working class or even poor, maybe for every dollar they put aside as savings, maybe there ought to be a matching something from the federal government just to create more incentives for saving. And we could go on. I'd also recommend that the Medicare drug benefit be amended so that the government can utilize its bargaining power. It has huge bargaining power, given Medicaid and Medicare, huge bargaining power in terms of purchasing drugs, so that it can use that bargaining power to negotiate better drug prices from the drug companies. That is now prohibited in that new Medicare bill. That's a form of corporate welfare, and it's unnecessary and it's expensive. Shall I go on?
No.
Okay.
Do you believe the U.S. is properly educating its youth in order to produce a globally competitive labor force? If not, what should change?
I do not believe that we are educating our young people. Our young people who are lucky enough to live in wealthy communities and go to extremely good public schools or private schools are getting fairly good educations. And we have the best system of higher education in the world. Still do. I'm not sure how long we're going to be able to maintain that. You in California have the best system of public higher education in the world. And I now have a direct vested interest in that system. Please maintain that. That is a jewel in the crown of America, let alone California. But too many of our middle class and working class families and their kids, too many of our poor kids are going to schools K through 12 that are inferior. The schools don't work. The schools have too many kids per classroom. Teachers are not adequately trained. The schools are too large. There are no after-school programs. And we're not doing anything for the kids age 0 through 5, although more and more evidence points to the fact that that's where the big payoff is. If you get to those kids, you can really make a difference in their lives. It's not just a matter of money. No, it's a matter of better incentives and better administration. I actually, a number of years ago, came up with an idea of what I called a progressive voucher. That would be a school voucher that families could choose from among a wide array of publicly certified schools. And the amount of the voucher per family would be inversely related to family income, so that poor kids would get a big, big fat voucher and rich kids would get a little tiny voucher. And it seemed to me that that progressive voucher system, ensuring that all the schools that they could be cashed in at would meet minimum standards, I thought that was a pretty good idea. And I thought it might also bridge the gap between liberals and conservatives, conservatives that like vouchers and liberals that wanted to spend more on the poor. Well, it turned out that I advanced the idea, and liberals hated it because it used the term voucher, and conservatives didn't like it because it cost money. So I lost everybody.
Okay. What, in your opinion, is the true unemployment figure in the U.S.? How many people whose benefits have run out are being ignored?
The Bureau of Labor Statistics uses two separate surveys to determine unemployment. One is called a household survey. It's a smaller of the two surveys. It's based on surveyors going around, knocking on doors, and basically asking, are you employed? And if not, are you looking for work? And the second is the payroll survey. It's a much larger sample, and it goes to employers, and it looks and sees how many new employees or fewer employees they are or have hired. Neither of those surveys is a terribly accurate measure because they tend to understate the true nature of what's going on. They understate unemployment because it's hard to find, even in both surveys, all the people who are too discouraged to even look for work. It's hard to locate and find all the people who are working part-time who would rather be working full-time. It's hard to find all the people who are working in jobs that they're overqualified for. In other words, while these surveys do give us a pretty good picture so that we can measure month to month relative to where we were before, they don't give a terribly accurate picture about overall how the American workforce is faring. There are other surveys, mostly, again, Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Commerce Department, not monthly surveys, but there are some broader and yearly surveys that suggest that things are not nearly as good as they appear in the two surveys I just mentioned. For example, we now know that the labor force participation of Americans, that's what percentage of adult Americans are in the labor force, the labor force participation has actually dropped from the year 2001. Now, that should be some indication that a lot of people are too discouraged to look for work.
What do you think will happen to our automobile and airline industries?
The automobile and airlines industries. Well, obviously, airlines are in a major shakeout, and the traditional carriers now have to compete with the likes of JetBlue and Southwestern, who don't have the same cost structures. JetBlue is non-union. Southwestern is union, but still, the cost structure is very different. And the major carriers are, almost all of them, in trouble. From a standpoint of the workforce, the real people of America, the workers in those airlines, if one or two of those airlines goes under, those employees will probably get jobs in another airline. I am not a fan of government bailouts or any subsidies going to any airlines to keep them going or any other company to keep it going. But there is going to be a major shakeout. And one or two of them will go under in terms of liquidation. Already several of them are in reorganization. What about the car companies? Well, General Motors, my prediction for General Motors is that it will go into reorganization bankruptcy. It will in order to abrogate its labor contracts. You see, bankruptcy has now become, for some companies, a business strategy. It's the only way they believe, of getting their labor costs under control and getting rid of some contractual obligations with regard to pensions and health care that they feel are too onerous relative to their competitors. The airlines did it, I think. My prediction is GM will be the next to do it. If that's the case, watch out for the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. That's the government agency that gets left holding the bag when what are called defined benefit pensions are basically abrogated, when big companies who owed them say, no, we're not going to pay them. The PBGC, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, already is deep in the red.
As a long-term four-day resident of California, I appreciate the number of questions with respect to real estate. And here's one that encapsulates a number of the audience's questions. Many of us here in the Bay Area are property rich and savings poor. What do you forecast for the housing market? And if we continue to develop farmland for housing, will we eventually be importing our food?
I don't want to restate what I've already stated, but I will just restate it very, very rapidly in a truncated form. The housing market is softening. I don't think there will be a bursting bubble. I don't think real estate values will drop dramatically, but I do think that they will level out. And there may be about a 5% decline in some of the overheated markets. Now, part of that is just the inevitable consequences of any speculative activity. People did not, over the last few years, have much left. You know, there wasn't very much activity to speculate in the stock market. Stocks were going nowhere. Bonds were going nowhere. So people started speculating in real estate. And real estate became the big speculative nest egg for many, many people here in California, back in my former home state of Massachusetts and elsewhere. And you couldn't have a conversation over dinner without it turning to real estate. By the way, real estate conversations, and I don't mean to offend anybody here, they are really boring. But people are obsessed by them, and that's what we talk about. About farmland, I don't know. I mean, look, California has a magnificent, magnificent land, scenic beauty. Please, whatever you do, don't destroy it.
Okay. What is your view of the strength of unions these days?
Unions, maybe to give you a comparison, in 1955, 35% of the American workforce was unionized. And that was a high enough percentage to mean that prevailing wages could be set by union contracts in most industries, and even non-unionized employees would get the benefit. Now, in the private sector, fewer than 8% of private sector employees are unionized. Now, that doesn't give unions any real power to set prevailing wages in almost any industry. And therefore, in every industry, unions and unionized workers are at a potential competitive disadvantage relative to non-unionized companies and their non-unionized workers. Now, can unions fight back? Yes, they can. Does globalization mean that unions are doomed? No. The fastest growing unions in the private sector are unions that are focusing on the poorest workers who are in the local service economies, retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation. They are not in these industries affected by global competition, obviously, because they're local services. And the best and fastest growing unions like SEIU and the hotel and restaurant unions, they are organizing like mad. My prediction: there will be a resurgence of unionism, but not in the big global industrial sector of the economy. It will be in the local service sector of the economy, and it's coming quickly.
Okay. A reminder for our radio audience: you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and professor at the University of California at Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy, who is discussing the national and global economic outlook for 2006.
You know, I should say, every time you mention the Goldman School of Public Policy, I look over and I see Richard Goldman sitting over there, who is a great benefactor of that school. And thank you so much, Richard, for everything you've done. Thank you. And not to avoid him, Michael Knocht, who is the dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy.
Well, turning from Berkeley back to D.C., many of us know that the current spending cycle in D.C. is not healthy. But how do you reach voters in a way that gets them to truly demand change?
It's a complicated question. Let me remind you that in 1992, Ross Perot put budget deficits on the national agenda. It is possible for a relatively few number of people who are sufficiently loud and stubborn and pig-headed, and I was not a Ross Perot supporter, please don't get me wrong, but he does deserve credit for getting the public to pay attention to that. I don't think Bill Clinton would have won in 1992 had it not been for all the voters who voted for Ross Perot and did not vote for the first George Bush. But there is also something else operating. I think there is a great deal of purposeful obfuscation. coming out of Washington as to what the numbers really are. And I think that if we had an administration and a Congress that wanted the public to know clearly what the national accounts were, there would be ways of making it much more clearly and much more accessible to the public. The Social Security debate is a good example. I've never heard so much demagoguery, so much fear-mongering over data that were publicly accessible if you really dug for them, but who's going to have the time to dig for them? The media also has got to do a much better job. Economic literacy in the media is up, certainly from what it was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, but there is still a lot of foolishness you hear in the media. The public just doesn't understand a lot of the basics.
Switching topics a bit here, on the immigration question, will we ever control illegal immigration if businesses are not sanctioned for hiring undocumented workers? What would be the economic consequences if we did change our policy?
Immigration, particularly of undocumented workers, is going to be one of the hottest and most difficult issues for us to deal with as a nation, and not only for us. We're talking about almost every advanced industrial nation in the world, for a simple reason, and that is that Europe and Japan and the United States are aging very rapidly. All our populations are getting grayer fast. We all have baby booms. And at the same time, in the poor parts of the world, you have very young populations that are huge and growing very, very fast. Now, that is a combination that, in a rational world, you could see coming out with a win-win solution. After all, who is going to keep our seniors, baby boomers, in the manner to which they become accustomed? You know, when I talk to baby boomers about the kind of expectations they have for their retirements, often I get back a response that I call a med retirement. That's a cross between a club med and a medical facility. Snorkeling in the morning and extra oxygen in the afternoon. You see, their expectations are very high and very expensive. Well, there's no way we're going to be able to afford that unless we have a lot of workers, a lot of young workers who are paying into Medicare and Social Security and helping the nation save. That means we've got to have immigrants. Where else are we going to get them? We're not reproducing. Even the baby boomlet is not big enough. We also need people to do a lot of jobs that a lot of Americans don't want to do. And there is a great deal of hypocrisy among those who say we ought to stop immigration when they turn around and they actually depend on a lot of immigrants, some of whom are undocumented. But here's where it becomes tricky, because we can't simply allow everybody in who might want to come in from all around the world, because there is just not enough capacity in this society or any society to adapt quickly and accommodate quickly so many people. So again, the issue is, how do you manage the flow of immigration? We are going to have a flow, a huge flow. How do you manage it? I think that employer sanctions, telling employers that if they hire undocumented workers, they are going to be hit by big fines. Those employer sanctions are probably the easiest and best and most direct way to go. We're not going to stop people at the border as long as there is the powerful magnet of good jobs waiting for them on the other side of the border.
Change of pace. Please talk about the tech sector of the economy, pluses and minuses. The tech sector.
The tech sector of the economy, pluses and minuses. Well, the tech sector is resurrecting itself, Phoenix-like, Google-like. And I say that with some sadness. Route 128 around Boston used to be a big tech corridor, and there was a kind of competition going on between Route 128 and Silicon Valley, and guess what? You won. There is still a lot of activity around 128 and in Cambridge, my old hometown, but look, when people talk about the tech sector, they're indulging in a bit of false thought. There is not a tech sector. technology is affecting every sector of the economy. Information technology is changing the very face of the economy. We are soon going to be moving into nanotechnologies simply because the amount of memory and power on computer chips is going to require it. Individual molecules on those chips. We are going to be moving powerfully into biotechnology, particularly if we allow stem cell research. There is, in this country, a voracious appetite for new solutions to new problems. That is our gift to the world economy. It's our only gift to the world economy. No, that's not true. There are other gifts. But that is our major gift to the world economy, and there are enormous opportunities. The tech bubble that some of us are still recovering from was, in my view, an aberration.
Okay. Staying here on the left coast of the country, how will San Francisco and California in general uniquely benefit from the economic growth in China and Asia?
Well, China and Asia are the growing sectors of the world economy. California is uniquely positioned, along with Washington, the port of Seattle, Oregon, to benefit from that trade. Not only the trade, but also the direct investment. Not only the direct investment, but also the cultural aspects. When we talk about globalization, we often don't talk enough about the cultural richness of different societies around the globe exchanging their histories and their traditions with one another. And what a pleasure it is for me to come here and to look at my classes at the University of California, Berkeley, and see so much diversity, Latin America and Asia. It is a true richness. California will benefit, is going to continue to benefit, not only economically, but also culturally.
Turning to energy, a couple of related questions here. What is the realistic timeline for China's oil use to become dominant and therefore overextend the world supply? How can we as a nation balance this out? And a related question with this, why can't countries develop alternative sources of energy to end dependency on foreign oil?
Look, China's demand and Asia's demand for energy is exceeding our capacity to find new oil fields. Undoubtedly, technology will continue to find new sources of energy, and technology will continue to find ways of reaching new fields of oil and natural gas, but the supply side is not increasing as fast as the demand side of this equation, which means prices are going up. Now, price increases with regard to energy are the most important incentives for energy conservation and for alternative non-fossil-based fuel development. So in a way, it's painful, but in another way, it's a kind of a blessing because there's just a limited amount that the government can do in terms of stimulating alternative fuels. By the way, back to that energy bill last summer, there was not a single element, a single piece of that bill, not a single paragraph in that bill that will reduce our dependency on oil. And we need a government that is committed to alternative non-fossil-based energy fuels and non-fossil-based basic research and development. But having said that, let me also say that higher energy prices will stimulate the private sector to find alternative energy sources and also conserve energy.
Turning to taxation, question, what is the single most important tax to raise?
Well, I would say that with regard to the general subject of taxes, I mean, this is another area where we have demagoguery. I want to make sure that you all have a piece of data. Between 2001 and today, spending by the federal government went from 18.5% of our gross national product, gross domestic product, to 20% of our GDP. So that is an increase in spending. Undoubtedly, the Bush administration has increased spending as a percentage of our GDP. But listen to the revenue side. The revenue side is much more dramatic. revenues dropped from 19.8% of GDP in 2001 to 16.3% of GDP this year. That is a huge drop in revenues. People say, why do we have a big budget deficit problem? It is not on the spending side, folks. It is primarily on the revenue side. It's primarily because of those tax cuts and the false promise that those tax cuts were going to generate enough economic growth that we could pay for them. You know, that was Arthur Laffer's idea on a napkin. And they're still trying to sell it. And it's one thing to try to sell it. It's another thing to try to implement it. And it's another thing to implement it on the backs of America. Congress just cut $39 billion worth of Medicaid, that is health care for the poor, and child support, and low-income tuition assistance, and housing assistance, just cut $39 billion of that before Christmas vacation, before they went off for vacation. Now they're coming back, and they have on the books plans to extend the tax cuts of 2001-2003 by that would cost another $90 billion. Now you tell me how we can, in our society, where the gap between the rich and the poor is wider today than it's been since 1920s, and by some measures, since the Gilded Age of the robber barons, how can we justify that kind of fiscal policy, that kind of tax policy? I don't know.
Related set of questions from one of our audience members. How will the world get its debt under control? Will debt be inflated away? And then the second question, what is keeping the dollar from devaluing further?
Debt and the dollar. The dollar represents, in a way, our IOU to the rest of the world. The deeper we go in debt, the shakier that IOU becomes. Other companies, other countries, including the oil-producing nations, are in the process of diversifying out of dollar-denominated currencies as reserve currencies and into euros and other currencies. It's smart for them, it's understandable for them, but that means the dollar is going to drop. Now, people have been talking about the dropping dollar for years. It did drop the year before last. In 2005, the dollar didn't drop very much because the United States economy was beginning to revive. A lot of foreign money came here. But the dollar is on a downward slide. And there is no way to avoid it as long as we are going deeper and deeper into debt and our IOUs to the rest of the world become shakier and shakier.
Where are we regarding outsourcing? Is the picture better for U.S. workers than it has been?
Outsourcing. Rarely has a word gone so directly from obscurity to meaninglessness without any intervening period of coherence. Now, when we talk about outsourcing, every American company, every company, wherever it is headquartered, is doing more and more of its work everywhere around the world. Supply chains are now global. Toyota hires huge numbers of Americans to make automobiles. That means, or does it, that Toyota, headquartered in Japan, is outsourcing the production of automobiles to America? What in the world are we talking about? Now, undoubtedly, manufacturing jobs have moved. When I was a kid in New England, there were a lot of textile mills in New England. My father had a little dress store. He sold $1.98 cotton dresses to the wives of factory workers. And those factories all moved to North and South Carolina. But they didn't stay there. They then moved to Mexico. And they didn't stay there. They've now moved to China. And they're not going to stay in China either. They're going to move in the next few years to Vietnam and to India, Bangladesh. If we're dealing with the portion of the value-added chain, the supply chain, that is the most commodity-oriented, just basic manufacturing, doing the same operation over and over and over again, labor-intensive, to the extent that it is labor-intensive, it's going to go to the cheapest labor around the world. And there is pretty much inevitable, unless we wanted to be so foolish as to put up protectionist walls around the United States and say nothing can be built or done or produced outside the United States, and we would pay a fortune. Our problem, in terms of our labor force, is not something called outsourcing. Our problem in terms of our labor force is that we don't have enough people who are adequately educated to be productive in the emerging economy in the United States that is much more technologically intense than any economy before.
Unfortunately, we've reached that part of the program. There's only one question remaining, so I thought I'd make it an easy one. Do you ever intend to get back into politics? Why or why not?
Well, I thought I would use this occasion. Terminator one half. That's going to be my slogan. No, I'm not going to get back into politics. But at least not into elective politics. But I would, at a heartbeat, and I urge every single one of you to do the same, if, for example, an old friend calls you and he or she has just been elected president and says, please come to Washington and be in my cabinet, my advice to you is to say yes. Thank you.
Our thanks to Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and professor at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy, for joining us. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth of California, commemorating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.